welcome to episode 73 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Rick Lazio, former Republican member of Congress representing part of New York. Rick, how are you doing today?
Jordan, I'm doing great. Good to be on.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, I'm currently a partner in a law firm, and I run the affordable housing practice for the firm, Jones Walker. I'm also involved with a firm called Alliant Group, which helps smaller businesses get access to various tax credits for research and development and for energy efficient upgrades. I serve on several boards. I'm the vice chairman of Enterprise Community Partners, which is one of the largest community development and housing organizations in the country, and I serve on several other boards as well, not-for-profit boards. Previously, I was a prosecutor, served 5 years as a prosecutor on Long Island, mainly focused on white-collar and organized crime cases. I served 2 terms in the local legislature, and then was elected to Congress in 1992 and served 4 terms there, where I was the deputy majority whip and assistant majority leader before leaving and entering private practice.
Interesting. So I noticed that you had an interest in housing issues while you were a member of the U.S. Congress, and you mentioned that you currently maintain a portfolio at your law firm related to housing issues. What is it that originally sparked your interest in housing issues? How did you get involved in that particular topic area?
Well, New York, most of your listeners will know, it's a high-cost area, and so people generally struggle with the cost of housing. And this is true in many parts of the country now. There's actually no state in America where less than 37% of the renters are not what we call rent burdened. They're paying more than 30% of their income in rent. So it's sometimes viewed as a situation that impacts primarily the coasts, but that's not truly the case. It actually is broadly impacting America, and it's getting worse. It's been getting worse for probably 50 years. I first got involved in it because I was named to the committee as a newly elected member of Congress, and there had been no Republicans who had chaired the Housing Committee for 40 years before that, because Republicans hadn't been in control for 40 years. But in 1994, lightning struck, and Republicans did come into the majority for the first time in 2 generations, and I was handed the gavel and given responsibility for reviewing, overhauling housing programs, federal housing programs, and I began that by traveling the country. Before I set off to decide what to do, I said to the Speaker of the House, give me time to go out into the field and talk to people, the activists, the residents, the owners, the private sector, the public housing authorities, the mayors and the governors around the country, and primarily the residents, really, to find out what was working and what wasn't working. I came back and created a reform.
I want to interject right there before we get on to what you did once you came back, and just talk about that trip across America right now. I do know that on the local level in some states, and I'd like to ask perhaps if it exists also on a national level, that there are jurisdictional issues, territorial issues. For instance, a representative from one area of the state of Maryland might try not to go necessarily on his own to a district in another part of the state of Maryland for fear of stepping on someone else's toes and so to speak, to be in someone else's backyard, so to venture outside of your own district. What I'd like to ask you is, did you encounter any resistance from other members of Congress in whose legislative districts you actually ventured into to explore housing issues? Was anyone reluctant to have you show up in their state, in their territory, speaking to their constituents when you were a representative from New York?
It's a great question, and in fact, is the case that it is considered somewhat of a breach of protocol for one member of Congress to go into another's district and have a general meeting or be involved in that district's issues without the invitation of a member who represents that area. So that's an accurate point. But when you're the chairman of the committee, it gives you a different standing to be able to go in. I often did invite the local member of Congress to join me on either the tours, or sometimes we had field hearings. I'm thinking about one in particular in Chicago where we had a field hearing and had people from the opposite party that would come in. These are mostly urban areas. I was a Republican. Mostly these areas were represented by Democrats, but almost all of them were very happy that I was there because it meant I was bringing attention to the issue. I was focusing on things that they cared about and that their constituents cared about. So I never really had a problem. No one ever said to me, gee, I wish you wouldn't do this. I was always welcome to come in, and as I said, because I was chairman of the committee, that does give you standing to go in and review these federal programs in the various parts of the country.
Were there any difficulties that you encountered in being a Republican member of Congress, especially in a subject matter area that, as you mentioned, for the previous few decades had, you know, largely Democratic leadership that had been developing expertise in this area? So did you find any pushback? You said you cooperated well with local members of Congress. Did you find any pushback from members in your own party or members of the opposing party or of local activists that you were there? Or did you find that people were praising you for an attempt at bipartisanship? Or did you find that partisanship never really came across the table?
I think for residents, many of them were skeptical of any change. And so it was more about the possibility that policies would change that they were concerned about. Some were passionately for the change because they thought the life would be better. Some skeptical because they had seen promises made over the years that were never fulfilled by politicians. So I'd say for residents, there was more skepticism about a politician coming in than what party you were from. But it was a case that people often thought it was odd for a Republican to care about urban issues and care about housing and poor people. But I almost to a person, I think once they processed that, they tended to be inclined to be supportive. And of the fact that I was there, wanted to sort of share their story and their experience and what was working and, again, what wasn't working. It very often invite me back to their apartment to see, take a look at how they've set up their apartment and what they were dealing with. So there occasionally was some friction because of a partisan nature because I was a Republican and these were overwhelmingly Democratic areas. But the vast majority of times, it really was a sense of, I'm skeptical that you're a politician, and I know you're a Republican,
sure,
which is kind of odd that you're here, but I'm glad you're here.
So one more political question before we get back into the meat of the policy itself. Your constituents back in New York's 2nd District, elected a Republican, you referred to Newt Gingrich's Contract with America, 1994. I don't know what platform you ran on to get elected in that district, but generally speaking, it was a contract at that time many Republicans signed on to avoid raising taxes. And also want to call into attention that many constituents are really interested at the end of the day in what you can do for me. You know, I send you to the national legislature to represent me. What are you going to bring home for me? What are you going to do for me? So my question on this angle is, what did your constituents think about you going around the country and helping Democratic urban areas when you represented a largely suburban area of Long Island? Were you ever able to talk about that, or did they just care very much more about the constituent services that you were providing and weren't as interested in, you know, urban policy and their trips around the country?
Yeah, again, another great question. If I had just been traveling around the country and focused on federal issues and not been paying attention to local issues and constituent matters, I probably would have gotten into trouble, political trouble back home. But that wasn't the case. I had a very talented, very committed local staff. I came back every week to my district, was very visible there, spent a lot of time in the area. And I talked a lot about housing back home, so much so that it was ranked in the top three issues when we polled about issues that people most cared about. Now, that is very unusual. It's sort of an anomaly. But I attribute that to the fact that I talked about housing a lot. I talked about Habitat for Humanity and building houses and the need to house the elderly and have a place for families as a starting place for to launch their lives and to organize their lives, and talked a lot in terms of metaphors and stories that I think people connected with. In my district, which was what you'd call, I guess, a swing political district, there had been a Democrat representing the district for 18 years before I got elected. And a Democrat that succeeded me when I ran for Senate. So, and it had been carried by Bill Clinton when he ran for president. But I was carrying that district by about 2-1 when I was running after my first race. And I think it was because I reflected that district. I was pro-choice. I was pro-environment. Had gotten the highest rating from the League of Conservation Voters. Was a co-sponsor of the Brady Bill, supported the assault weapons ban, but was a fiscal conservative, believed in balancing budgets, living within our means, growing the economy, and the lowest taxes possible to be able to perform the functions of government. So that balance, which sounded weird in other parts of the country, they didn't know how that worked, but in New York and in a suburban area, it made perfect sense. And people rewarded that voting record and that those positions while I was there.
So just to make sure I understand what you said, you were saying that you're kind of a Republican because you're fiscally conservative, even though you're socially progressive. And you were saying that when you started running for the local legislature on the county level, and then when you first ran for Congress, maybe housing wasn't in the top three issues for most of your constituents. But after you had hammered in that message as part of your campaign on multiple campaigns for so long, you did some polling subsequent to a few victories, and you actually found that your campaign had changed the priorities of your constituents on the ground.
That's absolutely true. It wasn't just during the campaign. It was during the course of the of my term where I'd be holding press events and availabilities and visits at affordable housing communities and talking to residents. So we talked a lot about it and talked a lot about the fact that if you don't have affordable housing for our younger people, you're not going to have the workers to grow businesses, that your children, talking to the parents now, your children will move away. They're not going to have a place to live, that your parents are going to struggle or they're going to move back in with you, and you're going to be responsible for that. So this sort of sense that it was in their interest to be thinking about housing different than they had been thinking before, that it wasn't just about tall skyscrapers, public housing, and what they would view as concentrated poverty. It was more about creative ways in which you could develop affordable housing that was consistent with the character of the community.
Interesting. So I want to get back to the policy that we were speaking about a moment ago and that you were just bringing us back to yourself. So you went on that trip across America and you tried to figure out through conversations what needed to be done. How did those conversations affect the decisions that you were making in Washington? And what, if any, differences did your leadership present to national federal housing policy compared to housing policy under the previous democratically controlled House and leadership of your committee?
Well, the first challenge I had when I became chairman was to push back against the idea of abolishing the Department of Housing and Urban Development, known as HUD. And there was a strength, I think, on the part of Democrats after the Republicans won that they may have to do something dramatic on housing. On the part of many Republicans, that they wanted to eliminate three or four departments to streamline the government, and that HUD was one of them. And I pushed back very strongly on that and said, we cannot do that before we know what the replacement is or whether or not this, in fact, is the right thing to do. And I did get the support then of House Speaker Newt Gingrich to have the time to go out and have this tour of the country, and did engage with the then HUD Secretary under the Clinton administration, Henry Cisneros. But by the way, at the time, the Speaker was not meeting with any of the Cabinet Secretaries, but he did make an exception for me to walk in with Cisneros, who, by the way, to this day is a very, very good friend of mine, and have a conversation about our willingness to have a clear-eyed look at what was working and what wasn't working, and then to work together to sort of reform and change things so that it was more responsive to residents and more reflective of the things that we both wanted. So, the personal experiences were incredibly impactful. I brought them back when I talked on the floor. Eventually, I did write a bill, which was the most sweeping reform of public housing in 60 years. And I was on the floor of the House managing that bill for 2 weeks. So we had dozens of amendments. For that time, it was that term, those 2 years of Congress, it was the longest debate outside of campaign finance reform of any bill. And that bill ultimately passed with a huge margin. Almost all Republicans and over a third of all Democrats supporting this bill, sponsored by a Republican, written by a Republican, but addressing the issues that people broadly cared about. And it was a huge win. And eventually, the Senate didn't pass it the first time. The second time, I went through the process again, and it did get to the president's desk and was signed into law.
Oh, congratulations. Can you elaborate a little bit on some of the reforms that were part of that legislative package?
Sure. It gave residents a lot more more options. So for housing authorities, these are the organizations that run public housing. It gave them the ability to have more flexibility to spend money where they felt like they needed best. There were dozens of different subsidy programs, many of which were not really that relevant for different cities, different places, different buildings, and so we collapsed them into two, a public housing operating grant and a capital grant, so it made it much easier for them to be able to access that. We served warning on the housing authorities that were chronically failing. They had been rated each year and had awful scores.
And these are municipal? These are municipal or state
public
housing authorities?
Yeah, these are public housing authorities, right. So these would be what you would consider municipal. So they're funded by the federal government, but they're not owned by the federal government or managed by the federal government. They're managed generally by these local housing authorities that you could most fairly equate to municipal. And so it gave them it told them, listen, if you're failing every single year, we're gonna give vouchers to your tenants and let them go and find their own house. There's no reason for them to be trapped in a failing, crime-ridden, poorly maintained development. We're going to give them the power to go where they can find decent housing and have a chance at raising, you know, their children in a safe environment. For others,
so that,
we give them just much more flexibility.
So just to make sure that we're on, that the listeners and I are able to understand what happened, you're saying that your reform bill allowed tenants to have more choice in which affordable housing complex they would choose to live in. And when they selected a location, then their rent would be subsidized with federal dollars. Is that correct?
Yes, somewhat. So it would give residents who were in poorly functioning public housing authorities the ability to get a voucher that would travel with them and go into the market and be able to get an apartment, one that was even owned by a private apartment, but to use that voucher to pay for their rent. So it allowed them to escape an awful situation and find a situation that worked better for them. This is for the housing authorities that were failing every year. In other cases where the housing authorities were competent and they were managing things well, we gave them much more flexibility set standards, but backed off of micromanaging every decision that they had, and gave them more flexibility about rent range so that they could bring in people that were at the lower end of what we would consider working poor people. Many of these housing authorities wanted to have the role models, wanted to have people in the development that had information about jobs and were good links between the people who were unemployed and wanting work in public housing authorities and people that actually had jobs. So we did more around that. And in places like Chicago, we did a few pilot programs where working with the mayor, who was willing to put some city money into the pot to help these housing authorities, we took some of the worst public housing in the country, and those buildings came down. They were rehabilitated. They were upgraded. We had more secure situations where they would, so the city would put in more folks on the law enforcement side, because many of these places, the drug dealers would control the hallways. They would terrorize the residents. They wouldn't let them come out during certain hours. They turned the lights out. So we brought public safety back into many of these public housing authorities. So a lot of these places upgraded dramatically as a result of this bill. The residents enjoyed that because they were in safer environments. They got more upgrades in terms of their kitchens and bathrooms and their living conditions. There was a lot of pressure on the worst housing authorities that were poorly managed year after year after year to change management or to get voucher out. So there's much more accountability, more flexibility for the highly performing housing authorities, more options for the tenants, and looking back now, the authorized level of subsidy for public housing was much greater. Now this is over 15 years ago now that this bill was signed into law. It was more under that bill than it is today, and this is 15 years later. So there were more resources than today. There were, I would argue, dramatically better conditions for housing residents. And there were other bills that I was involved in that got signed into law. I also was involved in a bill to provide more housing opportunities for Native Americans on tribal land. And even though I didn't have any tribes or any reservations in my district, I knew that those conditions were really terrible and that there were lots of Native Americans who wanted housing opportunities, particularly to have a house on a reservation to raise their family. And it was very difficult back then. So I did write a bill, which also got signed into law, worked with Democrats. All these changes came on a bipartisan level. They all came working with the Senate. I was in the House. They all came working with Democrats, even though Republicans were in the majority. And they all came working with the administration, which was Bill Clinton's administration at the time, which also were Democrats. So they were all, I would argue, done with bipartisan support, with Republican leadership, listening first and acting second.
So I want to transition from, as we near the end of this podcast, I'd like to transition from housing issues and particular policies back to the topic of Rick Lazio. Now, you're only a member of the U.S. Congress for 10 years, and you've been alive for somewhat longer than that. You were also in the county legislature. You were a prosecutor. You have something called the Ignite newsletter right now. It seems as though there's been a common thread of public service throughout your life, and by definition, most of your life has not been in elected office. So though we focus most of this podcast on your time in Congress, as we conclude the podcast, I'd like to request that you speak about your general motivation for public service. Because right now, you're not running for Congress again. You're not running for anything. You're in a private law firm, yet you still have a debit. You have run for higher office before, but you have a continued dedication to public service that I think any public servant would find admirable. And I would like to just hear you talk about your motivations for continuing to serve, your motivations originally when you first got into politics, And why is it important to you to advance the public interest throughout your life, whether you're in elected office or not?
Well, I think it's public service is what someone once phrased to me as it's sort of altruistic egotism. So you feel good about yourself when you help other people, when you're making difference and you're having an impact. And I think public service, correctly understood and for the right reasons, is really about helping people in need and feeling useful, feeling as though you're contributing to something larger than the self, and getting positive feedback, you know, because of that. If you're doing it for the right reasons and you're doing it the right way and you're accomplishing things, there's a few things I think that can be more satisfying in life than for someone to look you in the face and say, you made a huge difference in my life. I remember a bill that I authored that helped disabled people go back to work and keep their Medicare that got signed into law. And looking at somebody who was in a wheelchair, who was disabled but had the ability through adaptive technology to be able to work and for them to feel as though they can fulfill their potential, and that somebody cared about them and that they had a sense of optimism about the future, is incredibly rewarding. Looking at a resident who, as I have, who stood on the front lawn and grabbed a piece of dirt and held it in a fist, clenched fist, and said, I can't believe this is mine. She had been living in a terrible, crummy basement apartment with her kids and moving numerous times, but now she had a place to call home and some stability, and to see that tear in her eye and for her to say thank you for what you did, that is incredibly motivating and rewarding. So those are the things, I guess, they're all about stories and emotions and how they touch you, how they inspire you. I always found that part of it, the people part of it, was the narcotic, the thing that kept me moving and pushing through obstacles and through frustration and through setbacks. It was always that sense that if you were determined enough and were at it for the right reasons and you were open-minded enough and you weren't so judgmental and inflexible, that you could find a way to be able to help so many people, and including people that you'll never meet. And that just is a huge buzz, I think, for someone like me, always was. People do it in different ways in their life. It's not just about public service. It's about helping, you know, whether you're helping, raise money for a local charity or helping in a boys or girls club or being a mentor or any number of ways that you can change a life. Those things create great buzz in your life, and I highly recommend it.
So that has been Rick Lazio, who speaks of an altruistic egoism where there is no shame in taking pleasure in making the world a better place. He has experienced great joy in applying himself, having discipline, working hard, gaining expertise in an issue, and then finding solutions, making people's lives better. At the end of the day, for Rick, there are human stories. There are human beings, and they're not constituents, and they're not votes. And it's not about how can I make the other party look bad, but for Rick, it's about these human beings who he is there to serve. And he gets a great deal of pleasure. In fact, calling the emotions he receives almost an addictive narcotic, that he feels almost addicted to helping other people. And when he solves those problems and makes people's lives better, that is what makes all the difference. And that is why he works to advance the public interest. So thank you so much for joining us today, Rick.
Jordan, it's been wonderful to be on. Thanks for your great questions and for the opportunity to talk to your audience.
And that has been episode 73 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.